They put out the first offering in March of 1985, 20 units at $10,000 apiece, a half a unit for $5,000. Ashby and Dauterman couldn't raise the money as partners in an accounting firm, but as individuals, they could talk to friends and say, here's a deal you ought to look at. And by the way, we're going to put our own money into it. It took a lot of guts to call people, said Dauterman. He told everyone, if you put your money in, kiss it goodbye. That's the only way to do it. One of the first people that Dauterman called was Art Coleman, a professor of marketing at Ohio State who consulted all over the country. Coleman signed up for a meeting, and what impressed him most about the meeting was how carefully Tommy spoke. Coleman called friends at Battelle who told him that Tommy was solid. He called Bill Arthur, who told him the guy had a hell of an idea. The Coleman family was in for two units. When Tommy arrived at Buck Patton's office, Patton had several pages of detailed questions for him. For 4 hours, he grilled Tommy on every fine point his honed business acumen could conjure. And when he finally ran out of questions, Tommy still had answers. He raised issues Patton hadn't asked about or even thought of. Patton was impressed. He asked Tommy to give him the probability of being able to locate the wreck, overcome the legal issues, and secure the gold for the investors. He thought for a while, recalled Patton, then he looked me square in the eye and said, 60%. Nothing could have been more credible. 2 weeks later, Buck Patton bought two units and sent a check to the partnership for $20,000. Many of the people Tommy met with thought he was a poor salesman. They'd seen the slick approach. They expected it. By contrast, Tommy was so precise and so careful to avoid overstatement that he made the project seem almost boring. You could almost see him figuring out how much fuel it was going to take, said Jim Turner, who bought half a unit for $5,000. Although many prominent citizens declined the invitation, Ashby was amazed at Tommy's record. 3 out of every 4 people who met with him wrote a check for $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000. He just had a way. He could sit face to face with you in landlocked Columbus, Ohio, and never take his eyes off your eyes, and tell you that he had an idea for working on the bottom of the deep ocean, where, by the way, no one has ever worked before, and recovering a gold shipment from a mid-19th century sidewheel steamer, and he somehow convinced you he could do it by telling you all the things that could go wrong. Don't know if we can find the ship. Think we can, but don't know. Don't know what the site will be like. Think we do, but don't know. Don't know if we have the technology to recover the gold. Think we have, but don't know. We do know the ship sank, that it carried at least 3 tons of gold, that it rests in about 8,000 feet of water, that no one else has recovered the treasure. And I think I can put together a project to do what no one else has done before. Find the remains of a 300-foot wooden-hulled ship in a stretch of ocean bigger than the state of Rhode Island and go down to the bottom and pluck the treasure from the wreckage with a robot. Don't know if we can keep the treasure. Think we can, but don't know. Don't know how to market the treasure. We'll figure that out. Tommy's greatest fear now was that word of his project to find the Central America might leak to someone in the deep ocean community. Outside of his small group and the partners now stepping up to invest, he wanted not one person to know the project even existed. That was critical. The ocean community is a very exclusive group of people, said Tommy, and it's hard to keep secrets. To show to potential investors, Tommy and Bob drafted a rough document of concepts. Robbie Hoffman had helped them write it. It didn't show the reader where to find the Central America, but it outlined the steps anyone would need to find and salvage the ship. Investors never even saw the document until they signed a non-disclosure statement. At meeting after meeting, Tommy admonished investors not to talk about the project. Within 3 months, Tommy had 38 partners who had invested a total of $200,000. Off the Carolina coast, midnight, Saturday, September 12, 1857. About 6 that evening, a man-of-war hawk tumbled from the grayness, then swooped across the quarterdeck, grazing Captain Johnson's shoulder. Seamen's superstitions long had held that an encounter with birds far at sea was a harbinger of danger ahead, but Johnson ignored the bird. The bird flitted into the rigging and then dived again and circled the captain's head in what he later described as an extraordinary maneuver. He ducked away. The bird darted over the deck, banked, and for the third time came at him. The bow of the Ellen heaved in a sea still pocked with hills of water blown white by a wind still harsh. On the 17th of August, the Norwegian bark had departed Belize, her hold laden with mahogany logs, her course aimed across the Caribbean Sea for the Straits of Florida to catch the Gulf Stream. Caught in the storm, she had made considerable water, lost most of her shrouds, and had her foremast ripped from the deck. As the storm's intensity lessened late Saturday, Captain Johnson tried to follow an eastern heading, but the wind had forced him to alter his course to just north of northeast. He had kept to the new course until the man-of-war hawk appeared in his rigging, and when the bird fluttered about his head for the third time, he resolved to reset his course to the original. As he explained later, "I regarded the appearance of the bird as an omen and an indication to me that I must change my course. I accordingly headed to the eastward direct." Around 1 a.m., with the helmsman on deck and the rest of the crew asleep below, strange cries near the vessel startled them. Johnson rushed topside. In less than a minute, I found that we were surrounded with persons floating in the water. The darkness of the night made it impossible to see them, but the voices calling for aid rang in my ears from every direction. Johnson and his men secured ropes and tossed them over the side, and in a few minutes they had raised four men from the sea, not one of whom could speak. Dr. Harvey and Second Officer Frazier still floated together, Frazier beyond exhaustion, chilled and sleepy. But when they saw a lighted ship in the distance, they paddled together against the current. The poet, Oliver Manlove, was picked up about an hour later. For hours, Captain Johnson continued to tack among the driftwood. By 4 in the morning, he had rescued 44 of the Central America's passengers and crew. Only two could stand up, talk, and help with the rescue of fellow survivors. One was the merchant sea captain, Thomas Badger. The other was Ansel Easton. Easton told Captain Johnson he had a friend he wanted to save, and he would pay the captain whatever he wanted if he would stay out there and try to find his friend. Johnson refused compensation, but he said he would stay as long as there appeared to be someone left to save. At daybreak, they were still tacking back and forth through the debris when they found one man alone and then two more together. A few more hours passed, and they found no one. Johnson said he thought they had rescued all the survivors and now should head for the nearest port. Easton persuaded him to tack just once more. Johnson came about for one last leg through the area with Easton at the rail, shouting for Brown. Around 3 in the morning, Captain Johnson had seen two men on a hatchway, but before he could tack to get closer, they had disappeared. Now, 6 hours later, they saw the same hatchway, and Johnson got close enough for a sailor to throw the two men a rope, which they caught, but they could not hold on. Johnson had to tack twice more, and on the second, the hatchway drifted alongside, and they pulled the two men on deck. One was a man named Dement. The other was Robert Brown. Johnson later reported that as the morning advanced and we found ourselves at a considerable distance from the place where the steamer sank, I bore down for it again. It was longitude 7613, latitude 3155. I first took an observation at 8 o'clock in the morning and again at noon. I saw the schooner spoken by the Central America before she went down, and do not think she picked up any passengers. After picking up all the persons I could discover, I sailed for Norfolk. While other ships weathered the storm and reported back to ports along the East Coast, the Marine sat becalmed from Tuesday through Thursday. On the morning of the sixth day, now Friday, they awoke to find themselves drifting within sight of the Cape Henry Lighthouse at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay outside Norfolk. Nearly a week had passed since the lights of the Central America had suddenly disappeared in the distant dark, and the Bosun Black had returned with the tidings that she had gone down and taken all hands with her. As the Marine rounded Cape Henry and entered Chesapeake Bay under tow, a harbor pilot boarded to guide them safely across the bay and around to Hampton Roads to the docks outside Norfolk. He brought with him the first news they had heard. 49 survivors from the Central America had arrived in Norfolk aboard a bark that very morning. That meant that for every 10 men who had remained with the ship, only one had survived, and the harbor pilot knew none of the names. It wasn't until late that night that Addie and Ansel were reunited at Norfolk's National Hotel. "Our meeting I will pass over," Addie wrote. "We wept together as well as rejoiced for several nights after. We could neither of us sleep, so vivid were the scenes before us that we had passed through. On Friday morning, via telegraph, news of the disaster had hit the streets of New York. The New York Times announced in headlines as big as it had ever printed, Central America foundered, 565 lives lost, only 60 saved. Of the nearly 600 souls aboard the Central America, 149 were saved. 30 women, 26 children, and 44 men taken on board the Marine, and 49 rescued by the bark Ellen. Besides the Eastons, Thomas Badger and his wife Jane, and Billy and Virginia Birch found each other. But the stories of happy reunions were few. Several of those interviewed said, "I have lost everything but my life." Ansel and Addie Easton repaired to the Metropolitan Hotel, where Addie wrote a detailed letter of everything that had happened since they set sail from San Francisco. "You never saw such a rejoicing as there was when we arrived," wrote Addie. "For 1 week after, we did nothing but receive calls and congratulations. I can't go in a store without hearing a whisper, 'There goes Mrs. Easton.' I have had so many interruptions and spent so much time on this letter that I shall not be able to write even to Brother Edgar. So please, after reading this to Sister Fanny, enclose it as soon as you can to my dear brother. It has been a severe task to me to recall those trying times, and I feel that I cannot even set down to write this all again." With those words, Addie Easton concluded her account of the disaster in a letter to her friend Jenny Page of San Francisco. The Eastons later returned to their home in California, where, after the Civil War, Addie gave birth to a son and then a daughter. 11 years after the sinking, Ansel was thrown from his beloved racehorse and died of his injuries. He was 49. When their daughter Jenny died giving birth to her third child, Addie raised the three grandchildren and lived to be 86. Still residing in the collection of the San Mateo County Historical Association is the little blue note Ansel penned to Addie, safe aboard the brig Marine, as the Central America lay sinking beneath him. The sinking of the Central America generated headlines across the country for weeks. The praise for Captain Byrd of the brig Marine and Captain Johnson of the bark Ellen was effusive. "The conduct of Captain Byrd was noble in the extreme," wrote a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily Evening Bulletin. "Like a noble-hearted sailor and true and gallant man, he bore down with his half-wrecked brig to the aid of those whose dangers and necessities were greater than his own." For his efforts, Captain Johnson received a gold pocket chronometer from President James Buchanan. But the praise was greatest for the captain who did not return. Everywhere his loss was mourned. The New York Times wrote of the calm, deliberate, enduring courage of a truly brave man. Frank Leslie's Illustrated said, "There cannot be a doubt about the fact that the name of Captain Lieutenant Herndon will ever be held in grateful remembrance among all the heroes who have achieved triumphs upon the sea." Captain Herndon's cousin and brother-in-law, the father of modern oceanography, Matthew Fontaine Maury, wrote Herndon's eulogy to the Secretary of the Navy. He wanted the world to know that a man had stood flat-footed at his post and lived an oath taken on a calm, sunny day that he would not leave his ship regardless of the danger. Forgetful of self, mindful of others, his life was beautiful to the last, and in his death he added new glory to the annals of the sea. In 1860, the United States Navy erected a monument at Annapolis honoring Captain Herndon, and to this day, it is the only memorial at the Naval Academy dedicated for heroism in time of peace. Columbus, Ohio, fall, 1984. The data correlation matrix on the wall at Bob Evans' house became a Lotus spreadsheet, 12 feet wide, 12 feet high. 59 survivors and ship captains had given their stories to the press in 1857, and 33 had made comments that would help locate the wreck site. The names of those 33 ran across the top of the spreadsheet, four names to a page. Heading down, each of the 15 pages contained three time blocks, each block representing 3 hours, beginning Tuesday at noon, just after the Central America had left Havana Harbor, and running all the way through Sunday midnight, when the Ellen had already been underway for Norfolk half a day. Besides an intimate understanding of the story, Bob was looking for three things: coordinates or distances in their time, the velocity and direction of winds and the height and direction of seas, and the condition of the vessel. Whenever a witness mentioned one of these, he placed it in the appropriate time slot under the witness's name. The idea was to reduce as much of the oral information as possible to physical data. I immersed myself in this stuff because we needed every piece of data that could have bearing on the sinking location. The stuff that went up on the Matrix were things about sails being ripped to shreds at 10 o'clock on Friday morning, things from which I could deduce wind strengths and wave heights and how far down the vessel had sunk at a certain point. One witness might say the same thing as another witness, but there would be a difference of 2 hours, and Bob would ponder the discrepancy. Which account was more likely to have occurred when the witness said it occurred? Did either witness have a reason for remembering the time? Have both witnesses consistently reported other events accurately? On the Matrix, in the Friday morning slot, appeared, "Vessel careened over on her starboard side, and we heard the beams crack." That's an interesting comment from Virginia Birch, noted Bob. None of the men put it quite as colorfully as that. Friday morning is all she says, so I put it in the 9 o'clock slot just because that's a nice mid-morning slot to aim at. Right next to that, you've got J.A. Foster reporting at 11 o'clock, ship over on beam end. He didn't actually talk about it happening, so you see there's a kind of different information there. Another passenger had reported that the storm was raging with unabated fury the minute they left Havana. But Virginia Birch said the 9 o'clock weather was fair. She continued, "On Wednesday at 3 o'clock, the winds commenced to blow with increasing fury." That's why the data correlation matrix became so important, said Bob, because whereas one man may remember that the storm raged with unabated fury from the time we left Havana, even Virginia Birch, a dance hall girl from San Francisco, knows that it was quite pleasant when they left. Bob kept trying to squeeze objective data out of the subjective observations of a largely unscientific group of observers. Witnesses reported sighting the Marine shortly after noon, or around noon, or about 2 o'clock, or about 3 o'clock. A lot of this testimony came from men who, first of all, had worked for 30 hours bailing water, then they were in the water for 8 or 10 hours, with no hope of salvation whatsoever, at night in the middle of nowhere, obviously going to die. And then they're rescued by this strange foreign vessel with a captain who has a heavy German, Swedish, Norwegian accent, who tells them some kind of story about this mysterious bird that led him to the spot. Coordinates were the most important information and therefore the most scrutinized. But one coordinate continued to baffle him. The same coordinate Tommy had found early on in the official report by the New York Board of Underwriters. But the men who had drafted the report had gotten it from the captain of the El Dorado, as the point where he had encountered the Central America only 90 minutes before she sank. It was the same coordinate that had confused Bob and Tommy earlier, because it was too far away from two coordinates taken aboard other ships. As Bob dug deeper into the documents, he pieced together this story. Upon sailing into Boston, the captain of the El Dorado had met with scandal. 90 minutes before the Central America sank, he had been close enough to shout across the water, but the El Dorado captain had failed to rescue even one of the desperate men. Such behavior raised the public ire when the El Dorado arrived in port, and the captain spoke only briefly with reporters, then disappeared. With the captain in hiding, the first mate had to answer the reporter's questions, and he produced the ship's log, which recorded several coordinates, and right there in the log was the site of the sinking. 31-25 north, 77-10 west, the same numbers that appeared in the official report. But to Bob, the coordinate looked suspicious. I'm sure that nobody else looking at this thing had ever thought that it doesn't really look right, but it doesn't. 31-25 latitude and 77-10 longitude, very precise coordinates rounded off to the nearest 5 minutes. And that was the problem. They were too precise. Bob studied the El Dorado log and noticed that, with one exception, every other coordinate entered was latitude only, how far north of the equator the ship had progressed. Latitude was the easy number to calculate, the part that a captain could determine by merely spotting familiar landmarks on shore or by dead reckoning, a sixth sense sailors developed at sea that enabled them to factor in the performance of their ship in similar seas, consider the distance from port to port and the latitude they had shot the day before at the solar meridian, and determine within 5 miles where they were. But longitude, the position of the ship east to west, was so difficult to determine that it required a chronometer to do so. Most mariners couldn't afford a chronometer, and only the extraordinary mariner, like Herndon, could calculate longitude using a chronometer and sextant. Captains sailing the east coast of the United States often reported only latitude. In the El Dorado log, Bob saw only once when the El Dorado neared the Florida coast and the captain identified a landmark did he record longitude as well as latitude. Until his sailing past the Central America, thought Bob, in the middle of the storm, at a time when they could not have gotten a coordinate, and then he renders this extremely precise coordinate. How could the captain of the El Dorado take a reading of anything at 6:30 in the evening? Even if the wind had been calm and the water like glass, there was nothing to shoot with his sextant. This seemed kind of weird to me, said Bob. He restudied every account concerning the encounter between the two ships. Most of the accounts said that Captain Herndon had yelled, "Our situation." But one account in the New York Tribune said that Herndon had shouted to the other captain, "Our position." Bob surmised that in mid-19th century English, the two could be synonymous. And whether the words were synonymous or misconstrued, they supported Bob's growing suspicion that the captain of the El Dorado had gotten that coordinate from someone else. He imagined the scene. Over 500 men gathered on the deck of the Central America, the steamer sinking beneath them. Captain Herndon shouts through his bullhorn as each captain strains to hear the other. The roar of 500 desperate men deafening. Captain Herndon wanting the other captain at least to know where he is. And somehow, the numbers loft across the water from the Central America to the El Dorado. And either the other captain or his mate takes them down. They must have gotten it from Herndon, concluded Bob. And that answered the question of how such a precise coordinate ended up among all the half-coordinates in the El Dorado log. But that raised another question. Did Herndon get the coordinate at 6 o'clock in the evening from a pitching and rolling deck in the middle of a hurricane? If not, where did Herndon get it? And in the answer to that question lay the key to finding the ship. In his research, Bob had seen references to the New York Herald, the major newspaper of the day. He knew the Herald had covered the sinking of the Central America in great detail. Bob found dozens of articles in the Herald, and he read them over and over. On September 27, 1857, there was a 3,000-word interview with Judge Monson. A third of the way through the article appeared this paragraph. On Friday afternoon, Captain Herndon came to my stateroom and asked permission to remove his instruments there from his stateroom on the upper deck. There was a possibility, he said, that his stateroom from its exposed position might be swept away, and his instruments. I complied with the request, of course, and the instruments were removed accordingly. To Bob, that made sense. Soon the deckhouse itself could weaken and be swept away, and with it the most important items Captain Herndon kept in his quarters, his navigational instruments. Bob continued reading, slowly trying to visualize the scene. Shortly after daybreak on Saturday morning, the clouds cleared away somewhat, recalled Monson, and the passengers and crew felt greatly encouraged. Captain Herndon stated to the men at the pumps that he thought the storm had abated, and if they would keep at work bailing till noon, the steamer might be saved. But soon, reported Monson, the storm had returned with an even greater fury. Then followed a curious paragraph. About 8 o'clock Saturday morning, Captain Herndon came into my stateroom. The captain told me then there was no hope for us unless the storm abated soon or some vessel hove in sight. As Bob was reading this last paragraph for the fourth or fifth time, he asked himself, now did the captain go there specifically to act depressed and talk to Judge Monson? That didn't seem likely. He had a ship full of people who were panicked and exhausted, and he would not be in Judge Monson's stateroom unless he had good reason. Bob knew that on Friday afternoon the captain had stored his navigational instruments in Monson's room, and that was the only reasonable explanation for his return in the morning to retrieve his instruments. But this raised another question. Why would Herndon be concerned with navigational instruments in a storm at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning? Sailors shot the solar meridian at noon, and that was only on days when they could see the sun. But there was another clue from Monson. Early that morning, the wind had abated and the skies had begun to clear. Everyone got all cheered about it, figured Bob, and he remembered another piece of information he had read a year earlier in the Philadelphia Ledger. Arriving in Norfolk, Captain Johnson of the Ellen had told his story about rescuing 49 men. But on the train to Philadelphia, other reporters asked the Norwegian captain again to recount his story. Johnson then told virtually the same story he had related in Norfolk, with one major difference. Someone this time asked him where he had picked up the survivors, and he replied, as the morning advanced and we found ourselves at a considerable distance from the place where the steamer sank, I bore down for it again. It was in longitude 76-13, latitude 31-55. I first took an observation at 8 o'clock in the morning, and again at noon. The celestial event at noon was obvious, the solar meridian. But Bob wondered then, how did he get a coordinate at 8 o'clock in the morning? What celestial event could possibly have occurred at 8 o'clock in the morning? Bob tracked down a nautical ephemeris chart from the mid-19th century and saw that a significant celestial event had occurred just after 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. And now, as Bob read Judge Monson's account over and over, he recalled that story, and suddenly it all made sense. The same celestial event had also occurred a little after 7 o'clock on Saturday morning. After shooting the event to take the coordinate, Herndon had probably returned his navigation instruments to Monson's stateroom, and that's when Monson saw him. And that was the same coordinate that Herndon had then shouted across the waves to the captain of the El Dorado, nearly 12 hours later, his last known position. "It was that moment of excitement," said Bob, "when I figured, that's it. I remember telling Harve about it. I remember talking in a very animated fashion to him about how I felt I had reached a very key piece of information. Bob told Tommy that Herndon was trying to save his ship. He hadn't seen the sun for 4 days, and he had no idea where he was. And being the intrepid guy that he was," said Bob, "he was not about to waste an opportunity to figure out his position. He might be close to shore, and if he's close to shore, they might have more hope for being rescued." "Well," said Bob, "you know why he was depressed? He's just figured out they're 200 miles offshore. I think he had hoped maybe he was closer to a shipping lane." The storm that had raged for 3 days was asymmetrical, and its eye was passing over the Central America early that Saturday morning. For a short while on that morning, as the clouds parted, Captain Herndon saw directly above him, cresting at its meridian, the pale white disk of the moon. The coordinate that had appeared in the underwriter's report, that had come from the El Dorado, that Herndon had shouted across the waves, Herndon himself had taken almost 12 hours earlier during the eye of the storm. And in that 12 hours, the Central America had drifted from that point to where the two ships met just prior to her sinking. And her wreckage had drifted on to the coordinate reported the following day by the Yellen. Finally, Bob had reconciled the odd coordinate, and it fit neatly into the pattern created by the others. Early in World War II, U-boats from the German Wolf Pack would drift silently in the Gulf Stream along the east coast of the United States, waiting to torpedo American convoys as they crossed the Atlantic. To deal with a variety of scientific problems early in the war, the Navy recruited an elite corps of physicists, mathematicians, and chemists to form the Operations Evaluation Group. High on the group's list of problems to be solved was how to counteract the German U-boats. One of the first reports the group created in 1942 was a rudimentary concept called search theory, which applied mathematical optimization techniques to varying sea conditions, such as wind and current, to predict the probability that a submarine would end up in a certain location. From that, they produced a formula for how intensively a pilot should search a given area. The Navy then brought in a well-known mathematician named Bernard Koopman to form a coherent theory, and within a year, the Navy was relying on Koopman's theories to sink German U-boats. One of the late-night letters Tommy wrote at Robbie's house had gone to Dr. Lawrence Stone at Wagner Associates in Sunnyvale, California. Since Koopman had died, Stone had inherited the mantle as the authority on search analysis. While Stone was advancing search theory, his colleague Tony Richardson was using computers to reduce the theories to coordinates on a grid. The two men had developed a system for the Coast Guard to find persons lost at sea. From there, they developed computer-assisted search systems for the Navy to track Russian submarines. Tommy had wondered for some time if the same methods Stone used to monitor enemy subs and rescue people lost at sea could also find a ship sunk long ago. Tommy called, and they kept in touch by phone. Then, in the early summer of 1985, Stone planned to attend his 20th college reunion at Antioch, only 50 miles west of Columbus. Stone arranged for them to meet in a private classroom. Early in the conversation, Stone referred to Tommy as a treasure hunter. "He bristled," recalled Stone, "and he corrected me rather sharply, so I tried to strike that from my vocabulary." Bob carefully unfolded part of the data correlation matrix. Stone perused the matrix and concluded he could turn their historical information into a probability map. The lawyers, Kelly and Loveland, filed a certificate of limited partnership with the Franklin County Recorder, which required them to disclose the names of the partners. And no sooner had they filed than a reporter for the Columbus's Newsweekly, Business First, saw the roster of elite Columbus citizens and was on the phone calling them for an interview. She called Tommy. "I'm really a scientist," he told her. "We're combining multidisciplinary efforts, historic research, ocean engineering, marine geophysics, deep water biology, and side scan technology." On June 24, 1985, the words Tommy dreaded appeared in the headline on the front page: "Treasure Hunt Attracts Prominent Executives." Although the article never mentioned the Central America, it revealed far more about the project than Tommy wanted known. And the three investors quoted used words like "take a flyer," "crapshoot," and "sunken treasure," the swashbuckling tone that Tommy had always been careful to avoid. This was Tommy's first brush with the media, and he saw how quickly the public's perception of the project could be skewed if he did not control the release of information. Tommy needed someone to help him convey to the public the serious and scientific aspects of the project. He needed someone to take all of the deep water shipwreck theories he and Bob and Robbie had roughed out in the concept paper and distill them into one clear, comprehensive document for the average intelligent investor. He needed a writer, someone who understood the media, someone he could trust. Someone like his old friend Barry Schatz. Since Tommy had left Key West in 1979, Barry had finished his degree at the University of Florida. He now served as an editor at the University Presses of Florida while pursuing his master's halftime. When Barry arrived in Columbus, the concept paper grew into a multidisciplinary approach to historic shipwreck recovery, or as Tommy, Bob, and Barry called it, the Blue Book. For partners in financial dealings, they named their company Recovery Limited. But for the public, they took the name Columbus America Discovery Group. With some of the seed money, Tommy had rented an old three-story red brick Victorian. Tommy used the house as an office, a place to work, to meet with investors, a place for Barry to live. Every Tuesday night and sometimes several other nights a week, Tommy, Barry, and Bob convened in the formal dining room to discuss the direction of the project. They called the meetings roundtables. They were the intellectual heart of the project, where the three men dreamed out loud. "We began to realize," said Bob, "that the more minds from divergent areas of thought you can get to agree on a given subject, the sounder the idea." Tommy sometimes had a short agenda of things he wanted to cover, but typically, he got no more than halfway down the list before their thoughts drifted elsewhere. Rather than steer them back to the agenda, Tommy encouraged the divergence. "With most people, there's a tendency to diverge slightly," said Tommy, "then come to a convergence. And by not diverging all the way before converging, you've missed out on all kinds of opportunities." Barry began to appreciate the mindset Tommy had been cultivating for a long time, setting out deliberately to do something that hadn't been done before and taking a very methodical approach to discovering how to do it. To raise enough money for the seed phase, Tommy had needed 20 to 40 investors to part with $5,000 to $10,000 apiece. Now he needed 50 to 100 investors to put up $14,000 to $28,000 each to raise $1.4 million for the CMARC search. But three things happened that summer that made the Central America project seem even more attractive. Fisher found the Atocha. A deep ocean contractor retrieved the flight deck recorders off Air India Flight 182, the 747 that had exploded in the air and plummeted into 6,600 feet of North Atlantic water. And Bob Ballard and his crew located the Titanic on a depth sounder. "It was like all these things that Tommy had been talking about really can happen," said Ashby. It had a very positive impact on the people that Tommy was talking to. Out of the 38 partners in the seed phase, all but a half a dozen anteed up for the search phase. By the end of 1985, the search phase, nearly 100 investors, was fully subscribed, and Tommy had $1.4 million to go find the Central America. Already, Tommy, Bob, and Barry had found her in thought and on paper. Now they had to find her in the deep blue sea. 2 weeks after Larry Stone had met with Tommy and Bob, Tommy sent him a check for $10,000 to begin the first analysis of the data. For his initial analysis, he produced rough maps, one of each of the three scenarios they had chosen, one around the Ellen coordinate, one around the Central America coordinate, and one around the Marine coordinate. He took all of the information Bob had given him, converted it to mathematics, and computed each scenario separately by tossing all of the numbers into a computer, which absorbed uncertainties by producing sets of pseudo-random numbers. Then he modeled each scenario 10,000 times. From this, he got a scatter of points, each a possible location of the target. Over the scatter, he drew a grid of 2-mile square cells, counted up the number of points that fell into each cell, divided by the same 10,000, and that gave him the probability that in that scenario, the Central America was located within that 2-mile square cell. But once he had mapped each scenario, he was not happy with what he found. He sent transparencies of the maps to Tommy, so Tommy could lay one over the top of another and see the problem. The three scenarios did not overlap as they should, which meant that the information somehow was inconsistent. A piece to the search map puzzle was still missing.